And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, September 16th, 2015. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My guest today is novelist and memoirist Gail Godwin. In the second half, Nicole Nelson will talk with Parnaz Farutan. First up is Gail Godwin. She's a three-time National Book Award finalist and the best-selling author of 14 critically acclaimed novels, including Flora, A Mother and Two Daughters, The Good Husband, Evensong, and Father Melancholy's Daughter, as well as the journals The Making of a Writer, Volumes 1 and 2, edited by Rob Newfield. She's received a Guggenheim Fellowship, National Endowment of the Arts grants for both fiction and libretto writing, and the award in literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. She lives in Woodstock, New York. Her website is gailgodwin.com, and she is here today to talk about her new book, Publishing, A Writer's Memoir, published by Bloomsbury. Hi, Gail.
Hello, Barbara.
Great to have you on the show. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Let's talk by hearing you, discuss the genesis of your new book, Publishing. How did it all come about?
It came about by the back door, really. Someone asked me to write an essay about women and work, and I started writing it. Actually, it turned into the chapter in the book called The Wings of the Dove, which is a sad chapter about an editor and publisher I had who took care of me for a few years and then was fired and then died. And while writing this essay, I decided I would have to write another essay for this Women and Work book because I wanted to keep this one for myself. And it evolved from there.
Interesting. It was so interesting to read your stories about publishing, because you got involved at a time when the business was still a time of, I don't know, gentlemen's handshakes and sort of, you know, less about the corporate entity and more about the books. And I'm just so curious how, you know, what the main changes you've seen occur since then?
Starting from the inside out, when I began as a published writer, authors didn't all the time have their pictures on their books. And there was much less image of a writer and much more the book. And then over the years, it became like having to go on the stage and then having to learn to dance and then having to learn to sing, and that was from the inside. The outside was, the thing I noticed most was my editors and my publishers kept getting fired and dying. So I went through a number of them.
You've had the same agent for something like 50 years, and it's longer than most marriages. So I'm so curious what that's like to have one agent for 50 years.
Well, he was the most stable thing in my writing life. He lasted through all of it. He died, and I'm working very well with his the Moses Cardona, whom he left the company to. I see my vocation, as I'd rather call it, it's gone through different phases, and it's almost like, well, someone said an artist's life is divided into these 20-year segments. I think Pablo Casals said it. And in the first section of your vocation or your career, you study. That's the first 20 years. The second 20 years, you practice. And the third 20 years, you perform. And the fourth 20 years, which I'm now in, you play. And I mean that in two ways. Starting with Flora, which was my last novel, I began to play. And I'm entering another phase altogether, which is exciting to me.
You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Gail Godwin. Her latest book is Publishing, a Writer's Memoir, published by Bloomsbury. You talk about being in Kurt Vonnegut's workshop, and you said something to the effect of he wasn't trying to make a lot of little Vonneguts. What stands out from your time with him?
What stands out is a laid-back, lifelong friend, and I see him with his hush puppies crossed on his desk and always a cigarette. He didn't have a lot of ego. He said once, "I just want to reach down in each student and pull out that little tape. It's way down their throat, and it's just theirs, and I want to try to bring it out." And he would roll along with you like a ship who knew how to roll along the waves. The project I had when I was working with him that year, I had written a long story, 40 pages, and it was good. I'd worked on it, and he sent me notes back that said wonderful things and critical things too, like sandbagging flashback. And then I said, "You know, Kurt, should I turn this into a novel?" And he said, "Oh, no, it's just fine the way it is." And then my next session with him, I said, "You know what? I'm going to make this into a novel." And he said, "That's just a great idea." You know, he just rolled right along.
Mm-hmm. And Robert Coover, you write a lot about Robert Coover as well.
He was an inspiration in quite a different way. He tried to get us out of whatever we were doing and make us approach it from another angle. And I do remember him coming into class. We called him the little magician. He had that look. And he would come in the class, and one time he had a stack of empty blue books, and he passed them out, and he said, "Okay, today we're going to write something. Here's what happened in the 11th century in a monastery. A monk found another story by Scheherazade. So just take it from there. You can write her story. You can write anything you want." And everybody did something different. I was taking a lot of old English then and studying medieval history. And I wrote about this young monk who was transcribing a manuscript and drawing pictures in the margins because his hands were cold, and then he comes upon this Scheherazade page. And then Coover took, I think there were 20 of us, he took all these home, and the next week he passed out this thing. He had collated all of it and arranged it in his own way, and it was a piece of work. I won't say it was a piece of art, but it was a piece of work, and it succeeded in making us try new things and getting the juices going.
You, unless I'm not remembering it right, I believe your first story was in Esquire, published in Esquire.
Oh my God, let me think.
Because I remember something about writing under Gordon Lish.
One of the first, and that was actually that story came out of Coover's workshop, and he was saying, "We've had enough of families and, you know, domestic situations and all that, but I wrote this story about I just made it very spare, like a fairy tale, about a woman who just suddenly realizes that it's too terrifying to be a wife and a mother, and she just retreats and retreats and retreats and retreats. And it was called The Sorrowful Mother. Gordon Lish was the editor at Esquire. He changed it to A Sorrowful Woman, and he added a first part that said, once upon a time there was one marriage too many. No, once upon a time there was a wife and mother one too many times. And that story has become so anthologized. I get emails all the time about what was the matter with this woman, what was wrong with her. And then others say, well, of course it's a fairy tale because the first sentence is once upon a time. So that's the story of my first publication.
I Googled it, and there are dozens of entries for this story, A Sorrowful Woman, and a movie, too, I believe.
Yeah, there's a great movie. A Japanese man did one. It's about 20 minutes, and it's just excellent.
Hmm.
And the film rights were hanging around for years, but they just couldn't do it. They couldn't make it. And there's even a little book you can get an e-book. It's just two pages about how to look at a sorrowful mother, woman.
Interesting. You talk about teaching. You taught for a long period while you were writing and when you were first publishing. I'm curious how teaching helped or hindered your own writing.
In my case, it didn't very much because I was teaching in the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and they're so good to their staff. You can work it so that you do your teaching heavy loads 2 days a week, and then that's that, and then you go off on your bicycle or whatever and hole up in your little apartment, and that's your time. So most of my teaching, the thing I had to worry about most was convincing everyone to be kind.
It should go without saying, right?
He had an easier way. He would just come in and say, all right, let's just remember today, we're going to try to do three things: be kind, and be kind.
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of teaching, on this show, we're always talking about MFAs because they've become controversial. And so now I'm curious what your opinion of MFAs are. Do you think they're necessary to a writer's career? Do you think they're incidental? What do you think?
I haven't thought about that. I got one, and by then I was so hooked into scholarship in general, because when I was an undergraduate at Chapel Hill, I had an average of 2.5. And I really had never studied, and I ended up staying at Iowa for 5 years and getting a PhD just because I wanted to. And I don't know if either my MFA or PhD ever got me a job. But this is so individual. It's so different in different cases. Hmm. You're almost required to have an MFA if you're going to teach writing at some college.
What if you're not interested in teaching? What if you're really just interested in writing, and teaching is not something that you really, really want to do at all?
Oh, I would say I would be a writer, and then I would teach boxing or mathematics or be someone's housekeeper. I'm not joking. Just do something really different. Mm-hmm. Clean houses. I once thought of that. Just clean houses real well, and then shut the door on the clean house and go home and write.
Hmm.
You have to make. Not many people can live on their writing anymore. you know, the Authors Guild just did this big survey, and it's really gone down a lot.
Yeah, sure
writers
has.
Just can't support themselves like they used to.
When you're writing, are you able to keep the marketplace out of your office? And have you always been able to?
I sure have. I hate the marketplace when I'm in my office. For instance, I just finished a book yesterday, and I've cleaned up my desk, and I'm preparing myself for how much visibility will be required of me to market my book. And I was actually joking, but then I realized I meant it. I said, I wish I could find some publicist who would help me get my book out there to new readers, because this is quite a different book, and leave me out of it, because the minute anyone sees me or hears my name, they think, oh, who's she? Or they think, oh, yeah. And I would like to have a way to come on it fresh. So now I'm thinking about the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
But I am going to get help. I am going to ask for someone who's really brilliant to tell me how to become invisible and get my book really visible.
Yeah, when you figure that out, let me know too, because
I will certainly do that.
You know, because you've seen so many changes in publishing, I'm curious if you have any suggestions for how publishers can better sell books.
It's rough right now. That's a good question. I think that publishers can do more for their mid-list and for the books they don't pay $1 million for. I mean, if you've paid $1 million, then you obviously have to spend some money. You don't see many ads for mid-list authors anymore, and you don't see the same kind of effort made to present each book as something new, something maybe quite different from the last book. So I would say pay more attention to what's really coming into your office from the writer.
Yeah. Well,
can you think of anything?
Gosh, you know, I mean, there's so much emphasis anymore on social media. You know, it becomes sort of upsetting how much emphasis there is on it. And I wonder if it really sells books.
I don't know, but I was on a panel earlier this year, and a small publisher actually was sitting on stage, and she said, when I'm deciding whether or not to buy a book, I first look up and see how many likes the person has. And I thought, down to the abyss for me.
Yeah.
You know, I think it'll pass. And things change. They keep changing, and even Facebook is now going to have a thumbs down, a dislike. So there's always something whipping around to the other side, saying we've had enough of, let's try something else.
Yeah. We are just about at the end of our time, and I was still curious, though, at what point do you show your work, and has that changed over the years?
Yeah, let's forget about the reading today, and I'll tell you about that. Because I used to show it in pieces, and especially when I needed some money, because you have to show something to get an advance. But my last book, Flora, I didn't show it to anybody because my agent had just died, and I thought I was going to ask to go to a new publisher. I didn't show it to anyone, and that was the most wonderfully liberating thing. So I did it again with this novel I just finished. It's a ghost story called Grief Cottage. I didn't show it to anybody. Now, the downside of this is on those days when you think you're nothing, you have no way to judge. You just have to be nothing that day.
Well, I love your writing, and I am so happy that I found publishing a writer's memoir. I think it's a lovely book, and I love the drawings, and I just think it's a wonderful writer's memoir. Thank you for writing it.
thank you. Well, Francis, that's the illustrator. We were actually playing with these drawings and where things should go. It's a lot of fun to play when you're in your vocation.
Yes. Well, thank you for playing with this because it was
okay.
Fun to read. And thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show, Gail.
I'm going to tell me how I can listen to it. After you get off the air.
Yeah, I'll talk with you in just a second. That was Gail Godwin. Her new book is publishing A Writer's Memoir, published by Bloomsbury. Stay tuned. Nicole will be with us with Parnaz Faritan. Stay with us. Be right back.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. The show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast and also available on Stitcher. You can always visit Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads as well as information on past shows and upcoming shows. We're also available on Facebook and Twitter. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. In the first part of the show, Barbara spoke with novelist and memoirist Gail Godwin about her new book, Publishing. Next up, I'll be speaking with debut novelist Parnaz Faritan. Parnaz was born in Iran and spent her childhood there. She has been named to the Hedgebrook Fellowship and Residency and received funding from the Elizabeth George Foundation, among other institutions. She received Penn USA's Emerging Voices Fellowship for her novel, The Girl from the Garden, published by Echo, an imprint of HarperCollins, which was inspired by her own family history. She currently lives in Los Angeles. I am pleased to welcome her to the show. Hi there, Parnaz.
Good morning, Nicole. How are you?
Oh, doing well. Thank you. So to start off our conversation, I'd love for you to introduce The Girl from the Garden to us. Could you tell us what the book is about?
Well, the story is a story that has been told in my family for generations. Back in 1917, there was these two Jewish brothers in Kermanshah. And the eldest brother, he was married, but he and his wife couldn't have a child. And so he takes a second wife, and she's doesn't have a baby either. And so we figure the fault of infertility is his. However, nobody mentions this, you know. And he gets rid of the second wife. And the younger brother feels so awful about his brother's predicament that he takes his infant son and he gifts it to his brother. And that child's mother, who was not consulted about this exchange, she essentially, dies of depression and sorrow for losing her baby. And that's the story. This story has been told in my family for years and years and years. And it's the basic story in the novel. However, it's told from the perspective of an elderly woman who's fashioned after my own maternal grandmother. And she's trying to figure out this story while also experiencing the onset of dementia. So as the story progresses, she becomes more and more lost in time and space and more of an unreliable character.
There's a lot I'd like to unpack from that story. So can we start first with you're hearing this story growing up and then your decision to write about it in the form of a novel. Do you remember having that first idea to do that with this story?
It wasn't even really my idea. It was something that was sort of bestowed upon me. And I know that sounds strange, but, you know, the way this story was told, the way I heard it growing up, was in a sort of communal oral storytelling tradition. You know, the elders of the family would sit around every time we'd have, you know, gatherings, and they would tell this story, variations of this story and about that family. And they would sit there, and one would begin, you know, and then another one would jump in, and they would build. And I would be sitting there listening, And then when it came time for me to write, and there comes a time when you realize you need to write, I realized that in order to sort of earn my wings, so to speak, I had to begin with this story. And then I had to figure out, like you said, how to tell it in novel form from the way I had heard it. It was my turn to become storyteller. And I didn't have the whole community to speak it, but I did want to capture something about the way a story is told by many perspectives. And that's one of the reasons why I chose an unreliable narrator. And, you know, how a story shifts by the way it's told.
Right. And I was interested that you did directly refer to Mabube as an unreliable narrator, because after I read the book, I went back and I reread the prologue.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was obviously carefully selected, because it has sort of a playful tone. Mm-hmm. And I think it prepares us for an unreliable narrator, or at least preparing us for the possibility that, you know, a story is influenced by the narrator and the way that the story is told. Can you talk just a bit about the prologue and, you know, whether you always knew the story would have one and how you settled on this one?
Thank you, Nicole, for noticing that. You know, the prologue is also a story that exists in our family. And, you know, the story goes that there's two stories as to how we ended up in Kermanshah, which is a province in Iran. And one story is that we had this great-great-great-grandfather. He was a coin maker for the king, and the king fell in love with his daughter, and this Jewish man, rather than giving his daughter to the Muslim king, escapes in the middle of the night, you know, to get away from the court to save his daughter. And then the second story is that this coin maker simply escapes in the middle of the night and arrives in Kermanshah a very rich man. And so there's within these two tellings of how we ended up, where we ended up, the main character has two totally different characters. In one, he's a hero. In another, he's a thief. He ends up rich because he's stolen the king's money, the coins that he's been making. And it's really fascinating to see that even within the stories of a single family, history can be so variable. You know, it can have so many different interpretations. And while I was doing my research for this book, I kept coming across these conflicting narratives, even in, you know, historical primary and secondary sources. You know, everyone had something different to say about that period and the politics of that period and the experiences of the people of that period. And so this theme became something really significant for me about how all stories, including history, including the current stories that were fed by the media, all these things are narratives constructed by an imagination, you know, a person's perspective. And so I wrote that prologue trying to capture that and you know, trying to kind of speak to the essence of how stories are told at the very beginning, you know, to sort of prepare the reader, so to speak, for the book also being not a factual history, but perspective and imagination.
Mm. I'm talking to Parnaz Farutan. Her new novel is The Girl in the Garden. The Girl from the Garden. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And Parnaz, would you read to us from your book?
Sure, thank you. I guess I'll read from the very beginning pages. And something that happens in the book before I read is that the narrator, Mahbuba Malakudi, is an elderly woman, and she's in her garden, and she sort of slips in and out of time. She'll be doing, you know, she'll be gardening, and then she'll slip into the past, and that's how the story is told. So I'll read the first pages to sort of show how that works. In the outskirts of Los Angeles, in the sprawl of suburban homes that sit in the lap of dry gold hills, there's a garden. In the warmth of late summer evenings, the perfume of honeysuckles and jasmines in this garden are maddening. Earthen pots of cosmos and geraniums surround the yard. Near the back wall grows a pomegranate tree. A fig tree fruits in the late summer. The grape arbor hides her clusters in among the leaves. The boughs of the apple tree nearly touch the soil in autumn. And the orange tree, soaking beneath the Southern California sun, provides year-round. Mint vines creep to cover the grounds. Nasturtiums explode and blossom. This garden belongs to an elderly woman. Her name is Mahbuba Malakuti. Her first name means the most beloved. Her last name means of the heavenly. Mahbuba tends to the trees and flowers of her garden, dirt in the creases of her hand. She pats the trunk of her trees and speaks to them softly. "This you must learn," she says to them. But the word paradise is a Farsi word. It means the space within enclosed walls, a cultivated place set apart from the vast wilderness. She talks to her roses, holds up a thorn stem and says, "First, I grate the end of your stalk." She rubs a small knife against the stem. "Then I bind you to the stalk of another rose." She wraps string about the two sticks and pushes them into the soil of a small pot. She waters the bare sticks and waits silently for the water to be absorbed. Then, after a long while, she says, "You'll take root. And once you have roots, you can grow in the soil of any garden." Her garden brims with blooming roses, yellow, pink, loose leaf, petals and candy stripe of red and white, pungent and scentless, long stems, short bushes. Each year she grafts more and more, searching for a rose with the color and the perfume of one she remembers from another garden. Mahbuba carries with her stories. They pour out of her and fill the spaces she inhabits like so many hungry ghosts begging to exist. Sometimes she forgets the parameters of that space, the dictation of time, and she slips into the past of her stories. The urgent horn of a car in the street outside her home sounds, and in her mind, Mahbuba hurries through the crowded streets of Tehran, a young woman again with her books clutched against her chest, her heels clicking against the sidewalk, her eyes focused on the end of the block, the turn that follows, to the gates of Danishsaraya Ali. She greets the schoolmaster who waits outside to ensure the safe passage of his charges. She enters the school, walks up the stairs against the marble of the hallway to the classrooms with its scent of chalk, its wooden desk, the chatter of girls laughing and talking. An instructor walks in, and the girls rise immediately and in unison greet him, "Salam aga mohibi," and he responds, "Be seated, class," before he picks up the chalk and begins writing on the board. Mahbuba copies furiously in her notebook, page after page, and at the end of the year, again and again and again, she's recognized as the best, the brightest among the students. The schoolmaster announces her name. She hears applause until a neighbor shouts in English, "I'm coming, give me a minute." Then Mahbuba looks about her as though she's waking from a dream.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Parnaz Farutan reading from her new novel, The Girl from the Garden. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And so, Parnaz, with that section, we have the introduction to Mahbuba. Mm-hmm. And you spoke earlier about how the story is sort of anchored on her and she lives in present day Los Angeles. But in terms of the structure, could you talk a bit more about figuring out that that's how the story was going to be told?
That figuring out took about 6 years. It was a really difficult process to figure out how to tell the narrative, and there's a million reasons, many of them unbeknownst to myself even. But one of the reasons was a political one. The decision to choose an unreliable narrator, you know, someone who's experiencing dementia. And we have these, the people of Iran are not very well represented. They're either not represented at all, or they're misrepresented, and this whole misrepresentation is a little bit frightening and a little bit dangerous. And so, when I wanted to tell this story, I wanted to pick a I wanted to pick a narrator that would intentionally, you'd have to question if she's representing or telling the story correctly. And one of the reasons was because, I don't know if you remember, or if listeners remember, back when Khalid Hosseini published The Kite Runner, it was on the beginning of the Afghanistan war, and all of a sudden The Kite Runner became this sort of, the voice of Afghanistan, and Khalid Hosseini became sort of the ambassador of the people. And it was a little strange to watch this, to watch one voice and one person represent an entire nation and history and culture of a people. And so I wanted to create a book that questioned that wouldn't allow for that in its very structure. That's one reason. Another reason is because, as I said, the narrator is actually fashioned after my maternal grandmother. And when I started this book, she was going through the onset of dementia. And she told me many of these stories when I was growing up. And then I watched her go through this journey, this existential journey and this journey in her mind. And the stories started changing, details of them. And it was fascinating to watch how her memory started becoming compromised, and how, something like there was this fresco, this painted image in the house. And, in her early stories, it was the biblical story of Moses. And then later on, it became the story of Rachel from the Old Testament. And so this actual thing, painted on tiles that existed, started shifting in her recollections. And it was really, philosophically brilliant to watch the story shift and change. The architecture of the home change, the people and what they did, and so I wanted to try to capture that also. The story is not a solid thing, even though it's caught between the pages, of a book written in word. There's so much that shifts and changes.
And seeing that shifting while speaking with your grandmother, what kind of effect did that have on you? Did it ease any of the burdens you might have felt to be, accurate? Or,
yeah, great question. No, the burden of being accurate is exponentially more difficult when you're taking on the task of representing people who have been misrepresented. You want to be, it's a very grave situation. You want to be as accurate as possible, historically, culturally. You don't want to make mistakes. So that burden is always there. It's very present, and it's a very heavy weight. And so I'm very diligent about research and learning. But this choice of a narrator also does kind of alleviate a little bit of that. You're right, because it allows us to say this story may not be true, and so then you have a little wiggle room for imagination or inaccuracy or even blatant lies if that's what the narrative needs.
Mm-hmm. How about your family? How did they react when they found out that you were embarking on this novel, and also now that it's available? What are their reactions?
Well, it's funny. The elders, those remaining whose memories are still, intact, they still sit around and tell stories when we gather. But now when they're in my presence, things have changed a little bit. They're a little bit more cautious of how they tell the stories. Everybody is very heroic and righteous in their own storytelling. They've become these fantastic characters. But then every now and then they slip and they get into the really juicy stuff. And they'll turn to me and they'll say, write about this. And it's lovely to watch. It's these people are very significant people in my life. And it's, you know, something about capturing their story when they themselves are sort of losing grasp of what had happened in the past. It gives them a sense of security, I think. And it's nice. It's nice to gift them that, to allow them that.
Mm. I'm talking to Parnaz Farutan. Her new novel is The Girl from the Garden. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And Parnaz, you mentioned earlier doing research for this book. What did that research look like? Was it, I imagine it went beyond interviews?
No, absolutely. No, there's the oral histories and asking directly. But, you know, I only keep certain books in my writing office, you know, and it's just the books that I'm using because everything else becomes a little overwhelming. But, you know, I researched agriculture in the Qajar period of Iran, you know, public health, you know, the culture and the ways of Kurdistani Jews, which were about as close to the Jews of Kermanshah as I could get, you know, and then things like actual artifacts, you know, for writing. You sometimes need to hold things in your hand, you know. Well, actually, I'm looking at something in my office now. It's the a book. This book is probably 100 years old, if not more. It's Rumi's Mathnavi O'Mathnavi. It's my grandfather's copy of Rumi's poetry. And in my great-grandfather, I'm sorry, Ibrahim would be my great-grandfather in the story. He's a character in the story. And he reads from this actual book often. And so just research isn't just, you know, like reading, you know, historical facts. Sometimes you kind of need to smell it and touch it. You know, you need to feel, get the feel of it in your hands. Right now I'm researching for book number two, and I'm listening to Gilbert and Sullivan, which is, you know, the music of the period for a particular person that I'm going to be focusing my story on. So you need to feel the music. You need to know what happened, on the nitty-gritty of life in that era, like, you know, how they packaged the wheat that they would you know, strap on the back of a mule and carry to the caravansary. But then you also kind of need to know what the music sounded like, what the streets sounded like. And in the early stages of this book, I did travel to Iran. It was my first time returning since we escaped in my childhood. And I would go to the bazaar, and I would walk in the streets, and I would, you know, try to let the soul of that country enter me, you know, to feel it, to hear it, smell it. You know, you need all that in order to reconstruct a world. So research is it's something really involved. It goes beyond just the books, you know.
And that touches on, in a moment I'm going to be asking you for writing advice for people writing their debut novels or their first novels. But I have one more question about your experience with this book, which is just regarding pace. You mentioned a 6-year period figuring out the structure. And can you talk a little bit about the pace and the drafting and what parts you've spoken about some struggles? Were there any parts that came, you know, more easily?
The stuff that comes easily for me, and I imagine it's different for different writers, the stuff that comes easy for me is the first draft, getting the meat of it, the emotional intensity of it, the actual experience of it down on paper. It just sort of comes, you know. I sit down, it takes me about a minute to situate myself on the keyboard and the chair, and then I lose myself, literally, you know. It's almost trance-like, you know. I look down at my fingers and they're just kind of moving across the keyboard, and I step back for a minute and I think to myself, oh my gosh, you know, it's happening. And then I got to get out of that frame of mind, because in order for it to happen, I can't really think about it happening, you know. The reason it took 6 years, I think, is because I haven't had the privilege of you know, studying writing. I'm an English teacher by trade. I've studied literature, but I've never, you know, attended an MFA program or anything of the sort. So I had to figure things out from ground up, like how to write dialogue, which is something I imagine you can learn very easily if there's a teacher guiding you through the process, or, you know, how to write flashback, or, you know, point of view and how that works when you're changing scene to scene. You know, all this stuff I had to just kind of figure out organically, and there was a lot of error and rewriting. And I think that's why it took so long to write, because in the process of writing, I was trying to teach myself how to write at the same time. So that's why. But the crafting takes a long time. But getting the soul of the book down, the first draft, that just comes like water, you know.
Mm. Well, we are drawing down on our time, but before I let you go, I'd like to ask you if you have any last brief words of writing advice for the writers listening.
Gosh, I don't know. You know, I'm new. This is my first novel. What advice could I give to folks? I think good writing, I mean, from a reader's perspective, I think good writing comes from the soul, the depths, you know, all that dark stuff deep inside you that you're afraid to touch. I think that's precisely where you need to go when you want to write. You know, you got to go there. You got to dig into the depths of things, you know. So I guess that sort of openness to your own being, you know, to not shy away from emotions that are terrifying, overwhelming, crippling. I think you gotta just face those demons, you know, directly, and talk to them and let them sort of guide you, because they'll take you to beautiful places.
Mm-hmm. Parnaz, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Nicole, for having me.
That was author Parnaz Farutan. Her novel, The Girl from the Garden, is published by Echo. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks to Barbara DeMarco Barrett for help engineering. Next week, Marie will interview Karen Joy Fowler about her new collection, Black Glass, short fictions, and Bonnie Jo Campbell on her new book, Mothers, Tell Your Daughters. Stay tuned for Positive Vibrations with Sister Rue coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.